Jesus' love is very wonderful. Jesus' love is very wonderful. Jesus' love is very wonderful. Oh, wonderful love. So high, I can't get over it. So low, I can't get under it. So wide, can't get round it. Oh, wonderful love.
Jesus' love is very wonderful. Jesus' love is very wonderful. Jesus' love is very wonderful. Oh, wonderful love. So high, can't get over it. So low, can't get under it. So wide, can't get round it. Oh, wonderful love.
Hello and welcome to the Holy Half Hour here on 3TFM with me, the Reverend Alec Noble, Minister of Saltcoats North Parish Church. It's good to have your company, and I also have a couple of guests in the studio with me. This programme features some great music and some of my latest worship sketches. In fact, this is volume 7 in a series. So, hence the need for extra voices. You are privileged to hear their world premieres right now, or put another way, you're the test pilots or the guinea pigs we're trying them out on. Anyway, see what you think. So, welcome to David and Susan Anderson. Nice to have you in the studio.
Nice.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
I should just say they've been friends for many years. David was my best man at my wedding, and Susan's been a minister in Kilmarnock, and they've now retired. So, let's get down to the first sketch. Belief, faith and trust. This is a son and his father.
Dad?
What is it, son?
What's the difference between belief, faith and trust?
Maybe they're all the same.
No, they can't be.
Why not?
Because they're all different words.
So?
Well, there wouldn't be three different words if they were all the same thing.
We use three different words for red, scarlet and crimson.
Yes, but they are three different shades of red.
That's my point. They're all red. Three different words for the same thing.
But I'm saying the three different words are for three very different shades.
Welcome to the wonderful world of Trinity. Three in one, one in three.
Eh?
God is Father, Son and Holy Spirit, but ever one God, world without end. Amen.
So what?
Well, God shows that you can have three in one. So back to your first question. Maybe belief, faith and trust are a Trinity. The same thing, but in three different shades.
Well, in that case, Dad, what are the different shades of meaning between belief, faith and trust?
What do you think, son?
I think you're fobbing me off.
No, I'm not. Believe me. I mean, trust me. Have faith in me. Take your pick.
You're making a fool of me.
Okay, son. Let's take a closer look at each of the three.
Right. What is belief?
When someone tells you something and you accept what they say is true, you believe them. You trust them. You have faith in them.
I thought we were just going to consider one at a time.
First lesson in Trinity, my boy, is that they always go together inseparably. But if it makes things simpler, we won't keep mentioning the other two. But be assured they're always there or thereabouts.
We believe in Jesus.
Now, that's an interesting leap you've just made.
How's that?
Well, it is one level to believe what someone tells you. It's a whole lot more to believe in a person themselves. Some people like to think that they can believe the things Jesus said and taught, but not believe in Jesus. Real believers believe in him, not just in his words.
You mean believing in your head is less than believing in your heart?
Yes.
Is that why we have to use different words?
Yes.
So which is which?
Believing in the sense of thinking with your mind, saying to yourself, I think he is right in what he's saying, is called believing, while believing in the sense of feeling with your heart, loving a person, saying to yourself, I feel he is the right person to go with, is called trusting.
So you believe words, but trust people.
Exactly. But remember that we're oversimplifying things. While belief, trust and faith are each quite different, they always go together.
So where does faith fit in?
When you believe what Jesus said and gradually begin to trust him, then you are said to be coming into faith.
But what does that mean?
Faith covers a lot of things. It involves belief and trust, and it leads you on to a whole new outlook, attitude, lifestyle.
How does that work?
Let me explain with a true story. Long ago, there was a very famous tightrope walker called Blondin. Every Tuesday and Thursday, he used to walk his tightrope across the falls at Niagara, the huge waterfall which connects America and Canada. He not only walked the tightrope, he did all sorts of daredevil tricks, walking backwards, sitting down, standing on his head, even used to push a wheelbarrow with his assistant sitting inside it. One day, a loudmouthed spectator was shouting his mouth off and irritating Blondin, so he pulled his wheelbarrow and his assistant back off the tightrope, and he went up to the man and he said, "Do you believe I can push across the tightrope a wheelbarrow with somebody in it?" "Yes, of course. I've just seen you do it," said the man. "Well, you hop in and I'll give you a shot," said Blondin. Surprise, surprise, the man declined his kind offer. He suddenly remembered he had an urgent appointment somewhere else.
So what?
Well, don't you see? The man believed that Blondin could do it, but he would not trust Blondin to push him across. He was not prepared to put his life on the line, as they say, and trust him with his life. Same with Jesus. Many folk believe Jesus lived, that he taught wonderful teachings, did amazing miracles, but they're not prepared to jump in his wheelbarrow and put their lives on the line for him and trust him completely with their whole lives.
Wow. You would need a whole new word for all that.
Exactly. And the word is faith. There is intellectual belief, there is heartfelt trust, and then there is total faith commitment. All three go together in a lovely trinity. Right, while you're recovering from that profundity, let's hear Catherine Jenkins singing a song about someone who nearly lost faith.
Where did I misplace my faith? Where did I set it down? Which one the day that I forgot what this was all about? And I came so close to throwing it all away, but I'm taking it back again. So come and rejoice, come and rejoice. What was lost,
sketch features Susan Anderson. Right, Susan, you ready?
I am. So, do you think we should scrap Trident?
Yes.
Why?
It costs a fortune.
But surely we need to defend ourselves. Security does come at a price.
There are other ways.
Like what?
Conventional armed forces.
But we are a small nation and we could easily be outnumbered.
Isn't there a bit of a sledgehammer to crack a nut?
It might be a big nut of a war.
Wouldn't it be better to stop things getting to the stage of war?
Yeah, in an ideal world. But what if all the diplomacy fails?
And that's where you would see a role for threatening the enemy with a nuclear bomb as a deterrent, eh?
Yes.
Well, let's think through this a little bit. Imagine that things have gone so far that the other side, whoever they might be, are thinking about launching the first atomic weapon.
Right.
So they calculate a surprise preemptive strike will give us instant victory.
But then they will have to reckon on the fact that we can retaliate with a nuclear bomb of our own.
Not if they get in quick enough and catch us unaware.
Ah, but we have sophisticated defence systems in place to give us early warning, and they know that.
So they would know that if they launch a missile, by the time it lands, we would know and we could launch our retaliatory atom bomb missile before the first one arrived.
Exactly.
So would you?
Would I launch an atom bomb?
Yes.
I think so.
You think so? You don't sound very sure. And remember that in the heat of the moment, you would not have the luxury of time to think about it.
I know. It is a big step to take. Maybe it's the sort of thing that you can never be absolutely sure of what you will do until it happens for real. You can think about it in the abstract, and you can decide when it doesn't matter. But in the heat of battle, when the crunch moment really comes, it's all very different.
Good point. So where does that leave the enemy making his calculations about whether or not you will strike back?
Well, his not knowing what we will do, because even we ourselves don't know, will sow a seed of doubt in his mind.
Surely for a deterrent to work, the enemy has to be absolutely certain that we would strike back. And even then, he might still not be deterred. Surely our uncertainty only tempts him to gamble all the more.
Perhaps. We still cannot tell what we would really do, can we?
Well, let's take this a bit further. Just suppose the enemy decides it is worth launching a nuclear missile. What is to be gained by us launching a retaliatory nuclear missile? This is what is known as mutually assured destruction. If you kill me, I will kill you, and we will both be dead. If we are not going to be allowed to live, then you will not be allowed to live either. If that does not put you off doing it, nothing will.
Yes, that is what will deter them from doing it. Nobody wants to die.
Ah, but that's where you're wrong. Many people nowadays are suicide bombers, jihadists, seekers of heaven by their own martyrdoms. Many people today are not even seeking heaven. As atheists, they have no conception of life after death in any form. Many have no desire to extend this life either. All they want to do is kill or be killed, die sooner or later, and mutually assured destruction perfectly fits their psychology of I'm not okay and you're not okay. Let's blow everything up in one big, world-destroying climax. Put simply, there's a growing death wish.
But that's only a minority of extremists.
That's the extremist minority I'm worried about.
But they don't have atom bombs.
Don't they? Atom bombs are spreading around the world. Some rogue states have them, like North Korea. Some collapsed states have lost them. Whatever happened to all the Soviet Union's missiles? And some shaky states cannot guarantee their security and might lose them, like Pakistan. Trident began in simpler times in the Cold War when the enemy was clear. It was East versus West, Russia versus America. But now it's getting ever more fragmentary and complicated. A very significant fact in this whole debate. Changing situations call for changing weapons and changing strategies. So in the light of that, if a minority extreme regime launched a nuclear missile, would you really retaliate and destroy the whole world?
The justification of Trident and other nuclear weapons is not all about using them. By then, it's probably too late. Their real value is in deterrence. But just the threat of using them serves the purpose of keeping the enemy at bay.
You mean it is a bluff? And if it fails to deter, then there's no value in actually using them.
Don't undervalue bluff. Such bluffing has kept the world in relative peace after two world wars.
Is that what you call this, peace? I remember this peace has included the Korean War, Suez, the Cold War, the Falklands War, two Gulf Wars, Northern Ireland, Iraq, Afghanistan, Israel, Congo, Rwanda, terrorism, just to name a few little bits of trouble with your peace theory.
But there have been no more nuclear bombs.
So the nuclear deterrent only really applies to nuclear wars, does it? So let me get this straight. You're saying that a nuclear deterrent has only been proven to deter nuclear warfare. Obviously, we've had conventional wars, and the nuclear weapons did not deter them, but we've not had a nuclear war, and obviously that is due to the fact that we have nuclear weapons. People having nuclear bombs makes a nuclear war less likely than not having them. Usually the prevailing wisdom is that having knives makes stabbings more, not less, likely. Having guns makes shootings more, not less, likely. I'm also tempted to think of the same logic prevailing in the joke about elephants and custard.
Elephants and custard?
Yeah, the joke goes, custard is great for hiding elephants. How so? Well, have you ever found an elephant in your custard? Nuclear bombs are great for stopping nuclear wars. Well, since we all got our nuclear weapons, there hasn't been a nuclear war.
Now, you're just being flippant.
No, I'm deadly serious. I'm trying to show the absurdity of nuclear deterrence. By the way, I still haven't found elephants in my custard, but I have discovered that there has in fact been a nuclear war.
Where?
Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan.
So what happened in that case?
We, the supposedly good guys, dropped the world's first two atom bombs on the supposedly bad guys.
And how did they react?
They died.
But Japan soon prospered after the war. Look at them now. Now we're all friends again.
Yeah, so that proves that nuclear bombs are good for you.
You see, that proves my point.
God help us. Now, next piece of music is Cliff Richard, Under the Gun.
Looking at a baby's face, I saw the plight of the human race dying to survive. Shaken by the irony, the anger rose inside of me and would not subside. But you're too young to understand, but the fate of every mortal man rests in someone's mortal hand tonight. In a nuclear insanity, there's a death watch on the land and sea, and I believe that we may never live our life. We were born under the gun, and just like every mother's son, we are hostage to the megaton, and the world could die tonight. Under the gun, we live in fear that the end will come. But there's one place to run to the sun. Everyone can see that the hour is late, and every soul on earth has got to demonstrate their loving if we're to survive. Cause we're tired of living on the brink, scared to death that our ship will sink in the winking of an eye. This course we're on's a big mistake, cause we all lose in the nuclear race. It's time to show all the heads of state that we believe,
we believe
that we're fighting for our lives. We were born under the gun, and just like every mother's son, we are hostage to the megaton, and the world could die tonight. Under the gun, we live in fear that the end will come, but there's one place to run. Under the sun.
Here's David and Susan.
I've bought a treadmill.
Oh, have you had a heart attack?
What?
Folk usually go on a treadmill in the hospital when they've had a heart attack.
Oh, I see. But you don't have to wait until you've had a heart attack before you go on a treadmill. You don't have to have a problem before thinking about a solution. It's a bit late when the horse has bolted. I'm using my treadmill to get fit so that I won't have the heart attack. Prevention is better than cure.
OK, so how long have you to go on the treadmill?
Just a few minutes at first, then I can do more and more.
No, I mean, how long is the treatment? After a heart attack, you do it for maybe 6 weeks. How long do you have to do it before having a heart attack?
Well, that depends on whether you overdo it or not, I suppose.
No, you still don't get what I'm meaning. How many weeks do you have to run on your treadmill so that you become healthy enough not to have a heart attack?
Oh, there's no guarantee that I or anyone will be safe from a heart attack.
Well, why bother then?
Because keeping fit increases my chances of not having an attack.
Maybe running daft on a treadmill will cause you to have a heart attack.
You seem very determined that I'm going to have some form of heart attack.
We often hear about people dying premature deaths because they overdid the jogging and fitness stuff.
Well, the key word there is overdid. Don't overdid it and you should be all right.
Oh, you wouldn't catch me dead on one of these treadmill things.
So where will we catch you dead? The couch? We all get carried away from somewhere, you know.
More folk drop dead in gyms than they do on couches.
More folk die in hospitals than in McDonald's. So if you're not feeling well, don't rush to hospital. Go to McDonald's instead.
Very funny. But it's no laughing matter.
No, you're quite right. Life and death is a serious matter. A matter of, well, life and death. Not as serious as football, of course, but serious enough.
So, how will you know when you can stop using your treadmill?
Why should I stop using it? I've only just bought it. And they don't come cheap, you know.
Are you seriously thinking you will use it for the rest of your life?
You make it sound like a criminal sentence. But if it gives you any comfort, I will probably overdo it and cause myself a heart attack and a quick premature end so that the rest of my life will not be such a long death sentence after all.
I wouldn't like to think of doing something for the rest of my life.
So you don't fancy brushing your teeth for the rest of your life?
I've got false teeth already.
Well, combing your hair then.
I'm bald.
There must be something you will be doing for the rest of your life.
Watching repeats on TV?
Anyway, don't think about anything in terms of the rest of your life. It sounds such a big take on. Take one day at a time, as Lena Martell and Matthew's Gospel advise us. Just say to yourself, today I am running on my treadmill, or today I am taking that pill the doctor gave me, or whatever it is.
Makes sense, but I'm still not keen on your running on the spot exercise.
Fair enough, but you do get the point that good habits are not just for 6 weeks, but for life, albeit one day at a time, whether it be teeth brushing, exercise, Bible reading, praying with God, whatever.
That was a great cue, wasn't it? Listen, we're going to keep going. We are marching in the light of God. There's someone around there marching around the tent. The church is marching out. Make a difference in the world. We are marching in the light of God. 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 We are marching, marching, we are marching. Oh, we are marching in the light of God. We are marching, marching, we are marching.
Ouch, ouch, ouch.
Oh dear, what have you done?
I've hit my thumb with a hammer.
Oh, not again.
Well, it's your fault.
My fault?
You wanted this silly picture on the wall.
Oh, so it becomes my fault, does it?
You gave me this shuggly pin.
And you managed to shuggle it as predicted.
How can anyone see anything with these newfangled varifocal specs?
Well, it helps if you keep your eyes open when you hit it.
I can see I'm not going to get any sympathy here.
Well, you are an accident waiting to happen.
It has already happened.
And not for the first time, even just today. Why does it always happen to you?
That's what I keep asking myself.
And what answer do you get?
Nothing. Not a thing. Why does it always happen to me?
You don't think it happens to anyone else?
I'm sure it does. and I bet they get more sympathy too.
Oh, where's my violin?
You always make fun of me, you know.
I'm only kidding you, you big softy.
It's bad enough having a thumb throbbing like blazes without you adding mockery to the pain.
Oh, you are a big softy. You'll survive. Just.
I would survive a lot better if I got some TLC now and again.
I think we've got some TLC in the medicine cupboard.
No, I mean tender, loving care.
Never heard of it. You'll need to try the woman next door.
Everything's a joke with you, isn't it?
No. I take jokes very seriously, if that counts.
Have you ever sat down and really asked yourself why everybody suffers so much?
No. No. So tell me, why does everybody suffer so much? Especially your poor self.
Well, I think it all comes down to just four possibilities.
Well, that is a big help. Case nearly solved. So who are the four suspects? Who done it?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't everything down to, number one, my own fault, two...
Stop right there. Case solved. What took you so long to work that out?
You always pick on me. Everything in life is my fault. I didn't vote for the last lot in government. You can't blame me for crime, cancer, cruelty and those cushions your mother-in-law gave me.
But you did tell her they were lovely.
Anyway, as I was saying, all the suffering in the world is not my fault. So the other theory is that, two, it's not anybody's fault. It just happens for no good reason. It's just life. We have to just grin and bear it. It's the way the cookie crumbles.
I'll be singing Case Hurrah, Hurrah with Doris Day's ghost any moment.
Some folk just can't bring themselves to face up to the harsh realities of life. Life is not always a bed of roses, with skies always blue, you know.
So I've noticed. Mind you, the first week of our honeymoon was nice, I think. So have you cracked it now? Is that the answer to the timeless trials and tribulations of life, ever since the dinosaurs had to put up with their mother-in-law's crazy cushions? The answer being that there is no answer. It's just the way it is, always has been, and always will be forever and ever. Amen.
Even you would not be satisfied with that explanation. I'm just getting to the real suspects in the world's greatest mystery.
Oh, well, don't keep me in suspense. My boiled egg is nearly ready.
There's always one of the suspects who takes everybody by surprise. The slippery, sleek-it one who operates in secrecy in the dark behind everybody's back. The real villain.
So who is that then, Dick Dastardly?
No, number three, the devil.
The devil? Surely not, I can scarcely believe it. Who would have guessed it? So the devil is the wicked mastermind behind all the evil in the world. Maybe you were cut out to be a detective after all.
You're only being flippant because you don't really believe in a devil, do you?
Well, I don't know. If there was no devil, I just can't think who to blame for your sore thumb.
My thumb is still throbbing, now you mention it.
And my heart throbs in sympathy with your thumb too. But anyway, my egg has boiled, so hurry up and reveal all. Who is your fourth suspect in the world's greatest mystery, the mystery of suffering? I must say it's looking bad for whoever it is.
We should really have a bit of a drum roll at this
point. Oh, get on with it.
And number four is God himself.
Oh, so now everything is God's fault, is it? He'll be pleased to hear that. So how, Sherlock, did you come to that perceptive deduction?
Well, it stands to reason that God is ultimately responsible for everything in the universe. After all, he created it all. He sustains it all. The buck stops with him, as they say.
So it's God's fault that he created hammers and nails and walls and pictures to hang and shugly pins and guys like you to hang them. And it's God's fault for not sprinkling enough DIY stardust on your infant head in the beginning so that you end up with a sore thumb. Nothing to do with your own incompetence, just being one of those things and just the way the cookie crumbles, and nothing to do with the nasty devil out to get you.
Well, maybe we could settle for varying degrees of responsibility between the four things. Maybe there's some truth in all of the theories.
And maybe a fair degree of rubbish spoken too. But what is true and what is false? That is the original question we started with. Meanwhile, your boiled egg is ready, and after it, will you finally get that picture stuck up on the wall?
So our Holy Half Hour has come to its end. So I'd just like to thank David and Susan Anderson for coming to the studio today and sharing so much with us. We appreciate it, and we look forward to another gig another time.
Pleasure.
Bye for now.